Cassette 20, Side 2. But his short-term memory was damaged. He was experiencing blankouts and tip-of-the-tongueism every day. Sometimes in the seminars he had to stop mid-sentence almost and sit down and wave at the others, asking them to go on. And they would nod, and the person at the blackboard would continue. No, he needed the solution to this one. There would be other puzzles to pursue afterward, without any doubt. The quick decline itself, for instance, or any of the rest of the senescence problem. No, there was no lack of the unexplainable to work on, and never would be. Meanwhile, the problem of the anamnestic was hard enough. The outlines of it were coming clear, however. One part of it would be a drug cocktail, a mixture of protein synthesis enhancers, including even amphetamines and chemical relatives of strychnine, and then transmitters like serotonin, glutamate receptor sensitizers, cholinesterase, cyclic AMP, and so on. All of these would be there to help in different ways to reinforce the memory structures when they were rehearsed. Others would be included from the general brain plasticity treatment that Sax had received in the period following his stroke at much smaller doses. Then it seemed from the experiments in electrical stimulation that a stimulus shock, followed by a continuous oscillation at very rapid frequencies phased with the subject's natural brain waves, would serve to initiate the neurochemical processes augmented by the drug package. After that, subjects would have to then direct the work of remembering as best they could, perhaps moving from node to node if possible, with the idea that as each node was recalled, the network surrounding the node would then be flushed by the oscillations and reinforced accordingly. Moving from room to room in the theater of memory, in essence, experiments with all these various aspects of the process were being run on volunteer subjects, often the young native experimenters themselves. They were remembering a great many things, they said with a kind of stunned awe, and the overall prospect was looking more and more promising. Week by week they honed their techniques and homed in on a process. For the work of recollection to best succeed, it was becoming clear from the experiments that context was an important component. Lists memorized underwater in diving suits could be recalled much better when the subjects returned to the seafloor than when they tried to remember them on land. Subjects hypnotically induced to feel happy or sad during memorization of a list were better at remembering the list when again hypnotized to feel happy or sad. Congruence of items in the list helped, as did returning to rooms of the same size or color when remembering them. These were, of course, all very crude experiments, but the link between context and power of recollection was demonstrated by them strongly enough to cause Sax to think hard about where he might want to try the treatment when they finalized it, where and with whom. For the final work on the treatment, Sax called up Bao Shuyo and asked her to come join them in Acheron for some consultations. Again, her work was much more theoretical and very much more fine-grained, but after her work with the fusion group in Da Vinci, he had a healthy respect for her ability to help in any problem that involved quantum gravity and the ultra-microstructure of matter. Just to have her run through what they had done and comment on it would be valuable, he was sure. Unfortunately, Bao's obligations in Da Vinci were heavy, as they had been ever since her much-heralded return from Dorsa Brevia. Sax was put in the unusual position of manipulating his home labs in order to extricate one of their best theorists, but he did it without compunction, getting Bela's help to put the arm on the current administration, to twist their arms as hard as ever he could. "Ka, Sax," Bela exclaimed during one call. "I never would have guessed that you would turn out to be such a fierce headhunter." "It's my own head I'm hunting," Sax replied. Usually, tracking someone down was as simple as contacting their wrist pad and looking to see where the person was. Anne's wrist pad, however, had been left on the rim of the Olympus Mons caldera at the descent station near the festival grounds at Crater ZP. This struck Sax as peculiar, since they had worn wrist pads of some kind or another since the very beginning in Underhill, Anne as much as anyone, as he recalled. Hadn't she? He called Peter to ask, but Peter didn't know, of course, having been born well after the Underhill years. In any case, to go without a wrist pad now was to borrow a behavior from the neo-primitive nomads wandering the canyon lands and the North Sea coast, not a lifestyle he would have expected Anne to take any interest in. One couldn't live in anything like the Paleolithic style up on Olympus Mons. Indeed, it required the kind of continuous technological support that was no longer necessary in most places, with wrist pads an integral part of it. Perhaps she only wanted to get away. Peter didn't know. But he did know how to contact her. "You have to go in and find her." At Sax's expression, he laughed. "It isn't so bad. There's only a couple hundred people in the caldera, and when they're not staying in one of their huts, they're on the cliff walls."
"She's become a climber?"
"Yes."
"She climbs for recreation?"
"She climbs. Don't ask me why."
"So I just go look at all the cliffs?"
"That's how I had to do it when Marion died." The summit of Olympus Mons had for the most part been left alone. Oh, there were a few low boulder hermitages on rim overlooks, and a piece had been built on the northeast lava flow that broke the escarpment ring surrounding the volcano for easy access to the festival complex at Crater ZP. But other than that, there was nothing to show what had happened to the rest of Mars, which from the rim of the caldera was entirely invisible under the horizon of the encircling escarpment. From its rim, Olympus Mons appeared to be the world entire. The local Reds had decided against putting a protective molecular dome over the caldera, something they had done over Arcea Mons. So no doubt there were bacteria and perhaps some lichens that had blown over on winds and floated down into the caldera and survived. But at pressures little higher than the original 10 millibars, they were not going to flourish. Probably the survivors were mostly endochasmoliths, so there would be no sign of them. It was a lucky thing for the Red Project that Mars's stupendous vertical scale kept air pressures so low on the big volcanoes. A free and effective sterilization technique. Sax took the train up to ZP, and then a car on up to the rim, a taxi van driven by the Reds who controlled access into the caldera. The car came to the edge of the rim, and Sax looked down. The caldera was multi-ringed and big. 90 kilometers by 60, about the same size as Luxembourg, Sax recalled hearing. The main central circle, by far the largest, was marred by overlapping smaller circles to the northeast, center, and south. The southernmost circle cut in half a slightly older, higher circle to the southeast. The meeting of these three arcuate walls was considered one of the finest climbing areas on the planet, Sax was told, with the greatest height of all, a drop from 26 kilometers above the datum, they used the old term rather than sea level, down to 22.5 kilometers on the southernmost crater floor. A 10,000-foot cliff, the young Coloradoan and Sax mused. The floor of the main caldera was marked by a great number of curving fault patterns, concentric with the caldera walls, arcing ridges and canyons across which ran some straighter escarpments. These features were all explicable. They had been caused by recurrent caldera collapses following the side slope drainage of magma from the main chamber under the volcano. But as he looked down from their perch on the rim, it seemed to Sax a mysterious mountain, a world of its own, nothing visible but the vast and bayed rim and the 5,000 square kilometers of the caldera. Ring on ring of high curved walls and flat round floors under a black starry sky. Nowhere were the encircling cliffs less than 1,000 meters tall. As a rule, they weren't completely vertical. Their average slope appeared to be just steeper than 45 degrees. But there were steeper sections all over the place. No doubt the climbers flocked to the very steepest sections, given the nature of their interest. There looked to be some very vertical faces out there, even an overhang or two, as right under them, over the confluence of the three walls.
I'm looking for Anne Claiborne, Sax said to the drivers who were rapt with the view. Do you know where I could find her?
You don't know where she is? One asked.
I've heard she's climbing in the Olympus caldera.
Does she know you're looking for her?
No, she's not answering her calls.
Does she know you?
Oh, yes, we're old friends.
And who are you?
Sax Russell.
They stared at him. One said,
Old friends, eh?
Her companion elbowed her. They called the spot they were at Three Walls, sensibly enough. Directly under their car, on a little slump terrace, there was an elevator station. Sax peered at it through binoculars, outer locked doors, reinforced roofing. It could have been a structure from the early years. The elevator was the only way down into this part of the caldera if you didn't care to rappel.
And resupplies at Marion Station, the elbower finally said, shocking her co-driver. See it there? That square dot where the lava channels from the main floor cut down into South Circle.
This was on the opposite rim of the southernmost circle, which Sax's map named Six. Sax had trouble making out any square dot, even with the binoculars' magnification, but then he saw it, a tiny block, just a bit too regular to be natural, although it had been painted the rusty gray of the local basalt.
I see it. How do I get there?
Take the elevator down, then walk on over.
So he showed the elevator attendants the pass the elbower had given him, and took the long elevator ride down the wall of South Circle. The elevator ran on a track affixed to the cliffside, and it had windows. It was like dropping in a helicopter or coming down the last bit of the space elevator over Sheffield. By the time he got down to the caldera floor, it was late afternoon. He checked into the Spartan Lodge at the bottom and ate a big leisurely dinner, thinking from time to time what he might say to Anne. It came to him slowly. A coherent and, it seemed, convincing self-explication or confession or cri de coeur, piece by piece. Then, to his great chagrin, he blanked the whole thing. And there he was on the floor of a volcanic caldera, the blinkered circle of sky dark and starry above, on Olympus, searching for Anne Claiborne with nothing to say to her, very chagrined. The next morning after breakfast, he pushed his way into a walker. Although the materials were improved, the elastic fabric necessarily clasped the limbs and torso just as tightly as their old suits had. Strange how the kinetics of it evoked trains of thought, flashes of memory, the look of Underhill as they were building the four-square dome, even a kind of somatic epiphany which seemed to be a recollection of his very first walk out of the landing craft, with the surprise of the close horizons and the textured pink of the sky. Context and memory, again. He walked out across the floor of South Circle. This morning, the sky was a dark indigo, very near black. Marine blue, the chart said, an odd choice of name considering how dark it was. Many stars were visible. The horizon was a round cliff rising on all sides, the southern semicircle 3 kilometers tall, the northeast quadrant 2 kilometers, the northwest quadrant 1 kilometer only, and shattered. Astonishing sight, actually, the roundness of it. Thermodynamics of cooling rock and magma chambers, magma throats. Out in the middle, the encircling walls were a dizzying sight. The walls looked much the same height in all directions, a textbook example of foreshortening's ability to telescope the perception of vertical distances. He tromped on at a steady pace. The caldera floor was fairly smooth, pocked by occasional lava bombs and late meteor hits and curving shallow grabens. Some of these had to be circumvented, a beautifully apt word in this case, as they were circumvents. But for the most part, he could tramp directly toward the broken spill of cliff in the northwest quadrant of the caldera. It took 6 hours of steady walking to cross the floor of South Circle, which was less than 10% of the caldera complex's total area, all the rest of which was invisible to him for the entire hike. No sign of life, nor of any disturbance to the caldera floor or walls. The atmosphere was visibly thin, everything equally sharp to the eye, right around the primal 10 millibars, he judged. The untouched nature of things made him feel uncertain about even his boot prints, and he tried to step on hard rock and avoid dust patches. It was strangely satisfying to see the primal landscape quite reddish, though the color was mostly an overlay on dark basalt. His color chart was not good at odd mixes. Sax had never descended into one of the big calderas before, and even many years spent inside impact craters didn't prepare one, he found, for the depth of the chambers, the steepness of the walls, the flatness of the floor, the sheer size of things. Mid-afternoon, he approached the foot of the northwest arc of the wall. The meeting of wall and floor came up over his horizon, and to his slight relief, the block shelter appeared directly before him. His APS setting had been quite accurate. Not a complicated bit of navigation, but in such an exposed place it was pleasant to be precisely online. Ever since his experience in the storm so long ago, he had been a bit wary about getting lost, although there would be no storms up here. As he approached the hut's locked doors, a group of people appeared from out of the bottom of a stupendously huge steep gully in the vast broken cliff face, debouching onto the crater floor about a kilometer to the west of the refuge. Four figures carrying big packs on their backs. Sax stopped, the sound of his breath loud in his helmet. He recognized the last figure immediately. Anne was coming in to resupply. Now he was going to have to think of something to say, and then remember it, too. Inside the hut, Sax unclipped his helmet and took it off, feeling a familiar but most unwelcome tension in his stomach as he did. Every meeting with Anne, it got worse. He turned around and waited. Finally, Anne came in and took off her helmet and saw him. She started as if she were seeing a ghost. "Sax?" she cried. He nodded. He remembered when they had last met, long ago on Da Vinci Island. It felt like a previous life. He had lost his tongue. Anne shook her head, smiled to herself. She crossed the room with an expression he couldn't read and held his arms in her two hands and leaned forward and kissed his cheek gently. When she pulled back, one of her hands continued to clutch his left arm, sliding down to the wrist. She was staring right into him, and her grip was like metal. Sax was speechless again, although he very much wanted to speak. But there was nothing to say, or too much. He couldn't even tell which it was. His tongue was again paralyzed. That hand on his wrist, it was more incapacitating than any glare or cutting remark had ever been. A wave seemed to pass through her, and she became somewhat more the Anne he knew, looking at him suspiciously, then with alarm. "Everyone's okay?" "Yes, yes," Sax said. "I mean, you heard about Michelle?" "Yes." Her mouth tightened. For a second she became the black Anne of his dreams. Then another wave passed through her, and she was this new stranger, still clutching his wrist as if trying to snip his hand off. "But now you're just here to see me."
"Yes, I wanted to."
He searched wildly for a finish to the sentence.
"To talk, yes. To ask you some questions. I'm having some trouble with my memory. I wondered if we could travel up here and talk. Hike," he gulped, "or climb. You could show me some of the caldera."
She was smiling. Again, it was some other Anne. "You can climb with me if you want."
"I'm not a climber."
"We'll go up an easy route, up Wong's Gully and over the Great Circle to North Circle. I've wanted to get up there while it's still summer anyway."
"It's LS-200, actually, but I mean it sounds good."
His heart was beating at about 150 beats a minute. Anne had all the equipment they needed, it turned out. The next morning, as they were suiting up, she said to him, "Here, take that off," pointing at his wrist pad.
"Oh, dear," Zack said. Isn't it really part of the suit system?"
It was, but she shook her head. "The suit is autonomous."
"Semi-autonomous, I hope."
She smiled. "Yes, but no wrist pad is necessary. Look, that thing connects you to the whole world. It's your manacle to space-time. Today, let's just be in Wong's Gully. It will be enough." It was enough. Wong's Gully was a broad, weathered chute cutting up through steeper cliff ridges like a giant shattered culvert. Most of the day, Sax followed Anne up smaller gullies within the body of this larger one, scrambling up waist-high steps, using his hands most of the time, but seldom with the feeling that a fall would kill him or do much more than sprain an ankle.
"This isn't as dangerous as I thought it would be," he said. "Is this the kind of climbing you always do?"
"This isn't climbing at all."
"Ah."
So she went up slopes steeper than this, taking risks that were, strictly speaking, unjustifiable. And indeed, in the afternoon they came to a short wall cut by horizontal fissures. Anne began to climb it without ropes or pitons, and gritting his teeth, Sax followed. Near the top of a gecko-like ascent, with his boot tips and gloved fingers all jammed into small cracks, he looked back down Wong's Gully, which suddenly seemed very much steeper in its entirety than it had in any given section, and all his muscles began to quiver with some kind of fatigue excitation. Nothing for it but to finish the pitch. But he had to risk his position time after time as he hurried higher, the holds getting slimmer just as he was becoming of necessity hastier. The basalt was very slightly pitted, its dark gray tinged rust or sienna. He found himself hyper-focused on one crack over a meter above his eye level. He was going to have to use that crack. Was it deep enough for his fingertips to gain any purchase? He had to try, to be sure. So he took a deep breath and reached up and tried, and as it turned out, it wasn't really deep enough at all. But with a quick pull, groaning involuntarily at the effort, he was up and past it, using holds he never even consciously saw, and then he was on his hands and knees next to Anne, breathing very heavily. She sat serenely on a narrow ledge. "Try to use your legs more," she suggested.
"Ah.
Got your attention, did it?"
"Yes."
"No memory problems, I trust?"
"No."
"That's what I like about climbing." Later that day, when the gully had lain back a bit and opened up, Sax said,
"So have you been having memory problems?"
"Let's talk about that later," Anne said. "Pay attention to this crack here."
"Indeed."
That night they lay in sleeping bags in a clear mushroom tent big enough to hold 10. At this altitude, with its super-thin atmosphere, it was impressive to consider the strength of the tent fabric, holding in 450 millibars of air with no sign of untoward bulging at any point. The clear material was nice and taut, but not rock hard. No doubt it was holding many bars of air less than would test its holding capacity. When Sax recalled the meters of rock and sandbags they had had to pile on their earliest habitats to keep them from exploding, he couldn't help but be impressed by the subsequent advancements in materials science. Anne nodded when he spoke of this. "We've moved beyond our ability to understand our technology."
"Well, it's understandable, I think. Just hard to believe."
"I suppose I see the distinction," she said easily. Feeling more comfortable, he brought up memory again.
"I've been having what I call blankouts, where I can't remember my thoughts of the previous several minutes, or up to say an hour. Short-term memory failures,
having to do with brainwave fluctuations, apparently. And the long-term past is getting very uncertain as well, I'm afraid.
For a long time, she didn't reply except to grunt that she'd heard him. Then, I've forgotten my whole self. I think there's someone else in me now. In part way. A kind of opposite. My shadow, or the shadow of my shadow, seeded and growing inside me.
How do you mean? Zack said apprehensively.
An opposite. She thinks just what I wouldn't have thought. She turned her head away as if shy. I call her Counter Anne.
And how would you characterize her?
She is, I don't know, emotional, sentimental, stupid, cries at the sight of a flower, feels that everyone is doing their best, crap like that.
You weren't like that before at all?
No, no, no. It's all crap. But I feel it as though it's real. So, now there's Anne and Counter Anne, and maybe a third.
A third?
I think so. Something that isn't either of the other two.
And what do you, I mean, do you call that one anything?
No, she doesn't have a name. She's elusive, younger. Fewer ideas about things, and those ideas are strange. Not Anne or Counter Anne. Somewhat like that Zoe. Do you know her?
Yes, Zack said, surprised. I liked her.
Did you? I thought she was awful, and yet there's something like that in me as well. Three people.
It's an odd way to think of it.
She laughed. Aren't you the one who had a mental lab that contained all your memories, filed by room and cabinet number or something?
That was a very effective system.
She laughed again, harder. It made him grin to hear it, though he was frightened, too. Three Annes? Even one had been more than he could understand.
But I'm losing some of those labs, he said. Whole units of my past. Some people model memory as a node and network system, so it's possible the Palace of Memory method intuitively echoes the physical system involved. But if you somehow lose the node, the whole network around it goes too. So I'll run across a reference in the literature to something I did, for instance, and try to recall doing it, what methodological problems we had or whatever, and the whole era will just refuse to come to me, as if it never happened.
A problem with the palace?
Yes, I didn't anticipate it. Even after my incident, I was sure nothing would ever happen to my ability to think.
You still seem to think okay. Zack shook his head, recalling the blankouts, the gaps in memory, the presque-vous, as Michel had called them, the confusions. Thinking wasn't just analytical or cognitive ability, but something more general. He tried to describe what had been happening to him recently, and Anne seemed to be listening closely.
So, you see, I've been looking at the recent work being done on memory. It's gotten interesting. Pressing, really. And Ursula and Marina and the Acheron labs have been helping me, and I think they've worked out something that might help us.
A memory drug, you mean?
Yes.
He explained the action of the new anamnestic complex.
So, my notion is to try it. But I've become convinced that it will work best if a number of the first 100 gathered at Underhill and take it together. Context is very important to recollection, and the sight of each other might help. Not everyone is interested, but a surprising number of the remaining first 100 are, actually.
Not so surprising. Who? He named everyone he had contacted. It was, sad to admit, most of them left. A dozen or so.
And all of us would like it if you were there, too. I know I would like it more than anything.
It sounds interesting, Anne said. But first, we have to cross this caldera. Walking over the rock, Sax was amazed anew by the stony reality of their world. The fundamentals, rock, sand, dust, pines. Dark chocolate sky on this day, and no stars. The long distances with no blurring to define them. The stretch of 10 minutes. The length of an hour when one was only walking. The feeling in one's legs. And there were the rings of the calderas around them, jutting far into the sky even when the two walkers were out in the center of the central circle, out where the later, deeper calderas appeared as big embayments in a single wall's roundness. Out here, the planet's sharp curvature had no effect on one's perspective. The curve was for once invisible, the cliffs free and clear even 30 kilometers away. The net effect, it seemed to Sax, was of a kind of enclosure. A park, a stone garden, a maze with only one wall separating it from the world beyond, the world which, though invisible, conditioned everything here. The caldera was big, but not big enough. You couldn't hide here. The world poured in and overflowed the mind, no matter its 100 trillion bit capacity. No matter how big the neural array there was still just a single thread of augmentation, consciousness itself, a living wire of thought saying, rock, cliff, sky, star. The rock became heavily cracked by fissures, each one an arc of a circle with its center point back in the middle of the central circle. Old cracks relative to the big new holes of the north and south circles, old cracks filled with rubble and dust. These rock crevasses made their walk into a wandering ramble, in a real maze now, a maze with crevasses rather than walls, yet just as difficult of passage as a walled one. But they threaded it and finally reached the rim of North Circle, number 2 on Sax's map. Looking down into it gave them a new perspective, a proper shape to the caldera and its circular embayments, a sudden drop to a heretofore hidden floor 1,000 meters below. Apparently there was a climbing route down onto the floor of North Circle, but when Anne saw the look on his face as she pointed it out, achievable only by rappelling, she laughed. They would only have to climb up out of it again, she said easily, and the main caldera wall was already tall enough. They could hike around North Circle to another route instead. Surprised by this flexibility and thankful for it, Sax followed her around the North Circle on its west circumference. Under the great wall of the main caldera, they stopped for the night, popped the tent, ate in silence. After sunset, Phobos shot up over the western wall of the caldera like a little gray flare. Fear and dread. What names. I heard that putting the moons back in orbit was your idea, Anne said from her sleeping bag.
Yes, it was.
Now that's what I call landscape restoration, she said, sounding pleased. Sax felt a little glow.
I wanted to please you.
After a silence. I like seeing them.
And how did you like Miranda?
Oh, it was very interesting. She talked about some of the geological features of the odd moon. 2 planetesimals, impacted, joined together imperfectly.
There's a color between red and green, Sax said when it appeared she was done talking about Miranda. A mixture of the two. Matter alizarin, it's sometimes called. You see it in plants, sometimes.
Uh-huh.
It makes me think of the political situation. If there couldn't be some kind of red-green synthesis.
Browns.
Yes. Or alizarins.
I thought that's what this Free Mars Red Coalition was. Arishka and the people who tossed out Jackie.
An anti-immigration coalition, Sax said. The wrong kind of red-green combination. In that they're embroiling us in a conflict with Earth that isn't necessary.
No? No. The population problem is soon going to be eased. The Issei, we're hitting the limit, I think, and the Nisei aren't far behind.
Quick decline, you mean?
Exactly. When it gets our generation and the one after, the human population of the solar system will be less than half what it is now. Then they'll figure out a different way to screw it up.
No doubt.
But it won't be the hyper-Malthusian age anymore. It'll be their problem. So, worrying so much about immigration to the point of causing conflict, threatening interplanetary war, it just isn't necessary. It's short-sighted. If there was a red movement on Mars pointing that out, offering to help Earth through the last of the surge years, it might keep people from killing each other needlessly. It would be a new way of thinking about Mars.
A new areophany.
Yes, that's what Maya called it.
She laughed.
But Maya is crazy.
Why, no,
Zack said sharply. She certainly is not.
Anne said no more, and Sax didn't press the issue. Phobos moved visibly across the sky, backward through the zodiac. They slept well. The next day, they made an arduous climb up a steep gully in the wall, which apparently Anne and the other red climbers considered the walkers' route out. Sax had never had such a hard day's work in his life, and even so, they didn't make it all the way out, but had to pitch the tent in haste at sunset on a narrow ledge and finish their emergence the following day, around noon. On the great rim of Olympus Mons, all was as before, a giant cored circle of flat land, the violet sky in a band around the horizon so far below, a black zenith above, little hermitages scattered in boulder ejecta that had been hollowed out, a separate world. Part of Blue Mars, but not. The hut they stopped at first was inhabited by very old red mendicants of some sort, apparently living there while waiting for the quick decline to strike them, after which their bodies would be cremated and the ashes cast into the thin jet stream. This struck Sax as over-fatalistic. Anne, apparently, was likewise unimpressed. All right, she said, watching them eat their meager meal. Let's go try this memory treatment, then. Many of the first 100 argued for sites other than Underhill, arguing in a way that they didn't even recognize as part of their group nature. But Sax was adamant, shrugging off requests for Olympus Mons, low orbit, Pseudo-Phobos, Sheffield, Odessa, Hell's Gate, Saba Shii, Senzani Na, Acheron, the South Polar Cap, Mangala, and on the high seas. He insisted that the setting for such a procedure was a critical factor, as experiments on context had proved. Coyote brayed most inappropriately at his description of the experiment with students in scuba gear learning word lists on the floor of the North Sea. But data were data, and given the data, why not do their experiment in the place where they would get the best results? The stakes were high enough to justify doing everything they could to get it right. After all, Sax pointed out, if their memories were returned to them intact, anything might be possible, anything. Breakthroughs on other fronts, a defeat of the quick decline, health that lasted centuries more, an ever-expanding community of garden worlds. From thence, perhaps, up again in some emergent phase change to a higher level of progress, into some realm of wisdom that couldn't even be imagined at this point. They teetered on the edge of some such golden age, Sax told them. But it all depended on wholeness of mind. Nothing could continue without wholeness of mind. And so he insisted on Underhill. You're too sure, Marina complained. She had been arguing for Acheron. You have to keep more of an open mind about things.
Yes, yes.
Keep an open mind. This was easy for Sax. His mind was a lab that had burned down. Now he stood in the open air, and no one could refute the logic of Underhill, not Marina nor any of the rest of them. Those who objected were afraid, he thought,
afraid of the power of the past. They didn't want to acknowledge that power over them. They didn't want to give themselves fully over to it. But that was what they needed to do. Certainly Michel would have supported the choice of Underhill had he been still among them. Place was crucial. That was all their lives had served to show. And even the people dubious or skeptical or afraid, and that is, all of them, had to admit that Underhill was the appropriate place, given what they were trying to do. So in the end, they agreed to meet there.
This ends side two of cassette 20 of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 21.